Good morning. I would like to call the House Education Committee to order. Today is February 20th, and let the record reflect the time is 8 a.m. Today we have present co-chair Representative Allard, Representative McKay, Representative Prox, Representative McCormick, Representative Story, and myself, co-chair Ruffridge. So we do have a quorum to conduct business. And I would like to remind the committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones or turn them off. The staff that will be assisting us today are Linda from House Records. Thank you, Linda, and Kelsey with the LIO. We do have the following three items on the agenda today. We are going to start with House Bill 9, which is adding a faculty member to the University Board of Regents. We're also going to be hearing House Bill 31, House Bill 65. It is the my intent to hear these as their first hearing and then set them aside for a later date. If we are ready, we will start with House Bill 9, and that is sponsored by Representative Carrick, and this is the first hearing of that today. You want to come up, Representative Carrick? Do you have a presentation by chance? No presentation. Okay, so we are just going to be hearing House Bill 9 from Representative Carrick, and it looks like we have Stuart Relay, staff to Representative Carrick, and then we do have a couple of folks online as well. Was it your intent to have invited testimony on this? Okay, so we do have a few people online as well. So whenever you're ready, Representative Carrick, take it away.
Great. Thank you, and good morning, chairs and members of the House Education Committee. Thank you so much for taking the time this bright Monday morning to hear House Bill 9, which would add a faculty member to the University of Alaska's Board of Regents. I'm Ashley Carrick. I represent West Fairbanks, and I happen to also have the University of Alaska Fairbanks in my district. I'm a former staff, faculty, alumni, and student at the university. And this is my first time bringing this bill forward as a legislator, although it's not my first time presenting this bill. In the previous two legislatures, this bill was brought forward for consideration by my predecessor, Representative Wohl. So today I just want to give a brief overview and explain why I'm bringing this bill forward again for consideration and have my staff, Stuart Relay, walk through the sectional. And then, as co-chair Ruffridge mentioned, we do have a couple of invited testifiers from each of the three main campuses in Alaska. So House Bill 9 brings greater representation to the Board of Regents. And when we think about boards and commissions in the state of Alaska, we typically think about these boards and commissions including folks that are representative of their particular industry or their particular specialty. So for example, the Board of Fish includes fishermen, commercial fishermen. The Board of Professional Counselors contains folks in that profession. And the members of the Board of Education typically have a strong understanding and perspective on our public education system. There's a lot of value in having an industry perspective on our state's Board of Regents due to the contributions of the University of Alaska to our workforce. But there's also a need to provide representation for stakeholders most impacted by decisions made by the board. So currently, there are 10 regents who serve for 8-year terms each. And a student regent is also a voting member of the board and serves a 2-year term. The student regent is on the Board of Regents as a way to provide additional representation for one of the most impacted stakeholder groups in the system. The student regent, though, is not just a ceremonial position. This is a full voting member of the board, and they have full board powers. To become a student regent, you have to have a 2.5 cumulative GPA, and up to two students can be elected by each major campus, and then a nominee is selected by the governor. The current role of faculty with the Board of Regents is that the Faculty Alliance is allowed to make a short, and I do mean short, report at the beginning of each Board of Regents meeting. And then after that, the regents can call upon individuals to answer questions, although in practice this doesn't happen as frequently as many faculty would like to be able to speak up on major issues. Looking at states around the country, there are six state university systems that have a student or a faculty regent, and 24 state university systems which have a student regent. In the previous legislature, there was one other state considering exactly the same type of legislation as HB 9 that would have added faculty and staff members to the Board of Trustees in Vermont. There are also a large number of private institutions that have a voting faculty regent as part of their membership. And one thing I just really want to impress on the members of the committee is that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to governing bodies for state university systems around the country. Every single state has a slightly different approach. For example, at Oregon State University and the University of Oregon, the Board of Trustees has 15 members, including 11 at-large members, one faculty member, one student member, and one staff member. At Pennsylvania State University, there are 38 members of their trustee board, and there are six at-large members, nine alumni members, and six agriculture members. So again, there's no one-size-fits-all approach. Just to give another couple of examples, in West Virginia's university system, their Board of Governors has 17 members with 13 at-large members, two voting faculty members, one voting student member, and one voting staff member. At the State University System of Florida, they have 17 members total, including 14 at-large members. The chair of the Council of Faculty Senates has a de facto voting seat, as well as the Commissioner of Education. And in Kentucky, there are 11 voting members, 8 at-large members, including one voting faculty and staff member. And in Tennessee, there are 18 members total, with 12 at-large members, one faculty member, one voting student member, and four ex officio members. So there's no standard approach, in other words, to fall back on. And the states which have a faculty member as a voting member of their board, when I've spoken with each one of those states, state university systems, they've talked a lot about the great value added that having that perspective, that seat at the table is. And as you can tell from some of those examples, there's never a dominance of faculty or staff or student members on these boards. However, we do have examples where we have that perspective added and there are voting members. So House Bill 9 is actually a fairly straightforward process. It somewhat mirrors the current process that we use to select a student regent. We would be increasing the number of the regents from 11 to 12. And the Faculty Senate, which is sort of the governing body for faculty at each of the three main institutions, University of Alaska Southeast, University of Alaska Anchorage, and University of Alaska Fairbanks, would each put forward two nominees, and that would produce a list of six from which the governor could choose one appointee and the legislature would confirm. So the appointment process is very similar to other boards and commissions. And again, there's that extra step of the governor choosing an appointee and the legislature offering confirmation. The faculty must be tenured to be considered. So we saw there were certain requirements for the student. You have to have a certain GPA requirement. For faculty, you must be tenured. And then if confirmed, would serve a two-year term. So again, mirroring that student regent role. The faculty regent in this bill would have the full powers of any other regent, including the student regent. So they would be able to vote, they would travel with the board to attend meetings, and could enter executive session with the regents. And because we're increasing the number of regents from 11 to 12, so from an odd number to an even number, we have a provision that a majority vote would be needed in order for a motion to carry on the board. So I'm bringing forward House Bill 9 because over the years, I've heard consistently from stakeholders in the community, as well as university faculty, that there's a real need for an inside perspective and for direct stakeholders to have input at the Board of Regents. I really want to emphasize that this is more than just a seat at the table. Right now, faculty don't have a very strong role with the Board of Regents at their actual meetings, and it's hard for faculty to sort of engage and bring that perspective forward formally in front of the board. Faculty would be able to do everything any other board member would be able to do. And this would improve the ability for that individual to provide stakeholder interest in the governance of the system. We also hold the student regent currently to a very high standard of professionalism. We expect the student regent to recuse themselves if there's a vote that directly impacts them. We also expect students to make really hard decisions. University's gone through a number of program cuts and administrative cuts over the last few years and just restructuring opportunities. And students are expected to be able to make decisions about potentially their own program being cut. I would argue that that's no less of a detriment to a student in our university system than it would be for a faculty member to potentially vote on something that could lead to the loss of their job. Folks who want to get educated in Alaska, want to stay in Alaska like myself, don't have many other options if their program is cut. And so that is one thing to keep in mind, is that we're holding the faculty region to a really high standard of professionalism, the same way we currently do with the student. And this ensures that the faculty, like the students, are given that representative and the voting interest in university affairs. And with that, I want to turn it over briefly to my staff, Stuart Relay, to walk through our sectional and our letter of support that we have. And then, as I mentioned, we have a couple invited testifiers.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Relay.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, Stuart Relay, Staff Representative Carrick, and thank you all for hearing this bill this fine morning. As Representative Carrick said, the bill is relatively straightforward, and so here goes the sectional analysis. Section 1 changes the membership of the board from 11 to 12 members. Section 2 requires that one of those 12 members be a tenured, a full-time current tenured faculty member within the University of Alaska system, and requires them to give up the faculty regent position if they are neither of those things during their term, if they lose their tenure, if they get fired, or something like that. Section 3 establishes the term length for the faculty regent as 2 years. And also one thing I forgot to mention, I apologize, in Section 2 is that it requires the governor to appoint a faculty regent from a list of nominees within 60 days of vacancy of the seat. And again, Section 3, term length of 2 years for the faculty regent. Section 4 establishes the process for appointment and confirmation. The faculty regent will be appointed by the governor from a list of 6 nominees that the faculty senate of each University of Alaska institution will elect to create the list. And they will elect 2 nominees. And it, again, confirms that it's a 2-year term. Section 5 says that a quorum for the board to conduct business would be 7 members, and a majority vote of the board is required to approve a motion, which means if it's 6-6, because it's an even member board, the motion would not carry. So you need 7 members to approve. And Section 6 requires the University of Alaska to hold elections on or before February 1st, 24. And that, Mr. Chairman. I also would like to draw the committee members' attention to the support letter we got from United Academics. It should be in your bill packet that was provided to the that we provided to the committee. It has 384 faculty members, excuse me, that have that signed on, and they signed on within 72 hours. This letter, as well as the invited testimony we will have today from faculty members from all 3 campuses, should hopefully illustrate how important this bill is for faculty members at the University of Alaska. And that is all I have, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank Mr. Relay. And before we go to invited testimony, is there any questions from the committee for the bill sponsor? Representative Hemshire.
Thank you. Through the chair, I don't know if you'll have this information, but has the current Board of Regents struggled to make quorum at any point without adding an additional member?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, I am almost certain they have not struggled to make quorum, but I think some of our invited testifiers may be able to speak to that too, because they closely follow the Regents' meetings as well.
Thank you.
Representative McKay.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Thank you for being here, Representative Carrick. And I'm just curious if you have, I couldn't find it in the paperwork, but do you have a list of the current regent members and their occupations, their backgrounds, their positions? That's somewhere where we could have a look at that, maybe?
Sure. Through the chair to Representative McKay, we can easily provide that to you for sure.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge, and welcome. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Rep. Carrick. One of my questions that I had involves your talking with other states about how it has worked having a faculty rep. And I know negotiations for salaries is, you know, one of the biggest decisions regents make, because personnel is a huge part of the budget. And how have other states handled that with their faculty rep?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Story. It's been a number of years now since I've done that initial deep dive into the states which do have a faculty regent. Although just anecdotally in the conversations I had with many of those states, it was just somewhat of a non-issue, actually. It was really interesting. I brought up the potential for conflict of interest and how do these systems navigate that. And as I think was illustrated by reading some of those states, these are somewhat large boards. A lot of times we had some of those boards have 17, 18, 38 members. And I think the purveying attitude is that folks are expected to have that high level of professionalism and to recuse themselves from voting and potentially in taking part in negotiations, outside of their role as a regent. And I think the faculty in Alaska would be interested in having those conversations as well. But when I had spoken to other states with a faculty and a student regent, they just expressed that it was not a major issue that they were facing with potential conflicts of interest. So
thank you.
Well, any other questions? Seeing none, just wanted to let the record reflect that Representative Hemshute joined us at 8:02 a.m. And it looks like we do have some invited testimony, and we will go to the folks. It looks like we have a couple online. We'll start with Nelta Edwards, Professor of Sociology for the University of Alaska Anchorage. Is that person online?
Good.
Hello.
Thank you so much. Hello. My name is Nelta Edwards, and I, as you said, I'm a sociology professor at AA, and thank you to the House Education Committee for hearing this bill. We are very much in support of it. I am also the treasurer of the faculty union. The union and all of the governance groups are in support of this bill. We think that it will be very helpful to the board and doing their business to have an insider, as it were, on the board to help them with just basic logistics questions about how the university does and does not work. And so we thank Representative Carrick and her staff for bringing this forward, and hope that you vote in favor of it. And I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Any questions for go ahead, Representative Allard.
Thank you. Professor Edwards, are you here as a member of UA or as an employee of UA, or are you here on your own as a private citizen?
I'm here as a private citizen.
Thank you.
But I'm affiliated with the university.
Thank you, Professor Edwards. Other questions? All right. Seeing none, thank you for being here and testifying, Professor. Looks like we will move on to Abel Bolt Ito from United Academics. Should be online from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. If you are online, you can begin your testimony, please.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
Thank you so much. My name is Abel Bilbito. I'm a professor of neurobiology and neurophysiology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I'm also the president of United Academics. I'm here as a faculty member supporting the HB9 to add a faculty member to the Board of Regents. I believe it would be very beneficial to the Board of Regents to have a faculty member faculty members' input in discussions on issues ranging from academic issues to a whole host of other issues that the Board of Regents takes care of. And I just think that since the Board of Regents currently have a large representation of business and professional people, there's not really an academic perspective on the board, and the faculty member who is currently teaching is engaging in research and providing service to the local and business or professional community would be very beneficial for the board. And to address a couple of questions that came up previously regarding, conflict of interest of a faculty member, I just referred to, for example, what happens when the student regent votes on a tuition increase. And the General Counsel of the University of Alaska has determined that that is not a large conflict of interest. It is a de minimis activity. So students are actually allowed to vote on whether they support or do not support the tuition increase. Also regarding the quorum, as president of the union, I've been at almost every board meeting in the last 12 years, and there never was a problem reaching quorum for the Board of Regents. Thank you very much, and I will be here to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, sir. Any questions? Representative Allen.
Thank you for being here today through the chair. So if there's not a problem with meeting quorum, is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
But we want to add a member to it, even though we don't have a problem meeting quorum, for a different perspective.
No. Generally, I would say in the meetings that I've been at, there's almost always have been at least 9 or 10 board members present. So adding an additional member and increasing the quorum by one member of the board should not be an issue.
Thank you.
All right, seeing no further questions, thank you for your testimony. And we will turn to, looks like someone in the room, Jill, and I'm going to mispronounce it, Dumesno. Maybe I got that right, maybe not. You can correct me on the record. Please come to the table and then give us your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Good morning. Thank you, chairs and committee. My name is Jill Dumasnil. I'm a professor of mathematics at University of Alaska Southeast here in Juneau, and am an elected officer in the statewide union, United Academics, that represents full-time non-adjunct faculty. I also support the addition of a faculty member to the Board of Regents. This addition will complement the existing student regent and ensure that faculty perspectives and professional experience delivering the educational mission of the university are taken into consideration when governance decisions are made. Currently, as mentioned by Representative Carrick, one faculty member, the Faculty Alliance Chair, is allowed 7 minutes to address the Board of Regents at each Board of Regents meeting. For other faculty members who wish to speak directly with the Board of Regents, we must telephone in to a 1-hour public testimony and are allowed only 2 minutes to speak. The addition of this regent has broad support among faculty, among faculty senates, and the faculty union. And I believe that it will foster better collaboration between faculty and the UA administration and build trust as well.
Thank you, Professor. Questions? Co-Chair Allard.
Thank you. Thank you. And through the chair, could you give me 2 to 3 examples of not having a faculty member on the Board of Regents that's been detrimental to the university?
Specific examples. I think that in particular when we were addressing program deletions or program cuts, that a faculty perspective would have been very useful in either which programs should or should not be cut and how the implementation might go to better serve students. So our accreditation agencies require that we do teach outs of our any discontinued program. It appeared that the regents were not aware of that. And so when you discontinue a program, it doesn't go away immediately. You can't just lay off all the faculty and save all the money. You have to have a 4 to 6 year teach out to ensure that all students that are currently in the program can finish. And so this is an accreditation issue. We also received a letter from our accrediting body. The Board of Regents received a letter from the accrediting body during some discussion of consolidation that was not in line with what would be required to maintain accreditation status. And so some of those controversies might have been minimized or avoided completely if there had been a faculty perspective in the early on in the discussions.
May I do a quick follow-up?
Absolutely. Follow-up.
Through the chair. But the faculty does have the ability to testify if there's any issues or concerns, correct?
In a 1 hour call-in testimony, and we're allotted 2 minutes to speak.
Thank you. Thank you.
Other questions? All right, seeing none, thank you for your testimony, Professor. Any other questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Hemshue?
Thank you, through the chair, Rep. Carrick. When I think of other sort of, so to speak, governing bodies, I think of the Board of Fish. Do the people on the Board of Fish have area expertise? Do you know the answer to that? I'm sorry. I'm trying to think. I would want, when I'm thinking of the representation I'd like to see communities represented, and is there a need then to also have the professional perspective on that board? So do you know about the makeup of something like the Board of Fish or the State Board of Education?
Yeah, so through the chair to Representative Hemshue, I don't know the specific composition of the Board of Fish, but my understanding is it's a good example to use because I think there's an effort, at least on the part of the administration, to make sure there's a regional balance, there's a perspective balance, there's industry folks, there's maybe folks that have a subsistence stake. And in general, I think that that's a good way to structure a governing body. And I'll just broaden it and use the legislature as an example. I think there's great value in having different industry perspectives in our body. And there's also great value in having former educators and former state employees like myself, and just having a broad variety of perspectives that are all stakeholders in the wider system that is being represented is really valuable. And just to follow up on Co-Chair Allard's comment from earlier, if I can as well, oftentimes that 1 hour block of testimony with the Board of Regents is taken up pretty quickly by students and faculty and others that are calling in. So there's pretty frequently a number of folks that don't get an opportunity to testify at the Regents meetings. It is a pretty large institution, and there's definitely a lot of stakeholders that want a chance to speak. And so I know that through some of the consolidation conversations a couple of years ago and budget cuts and just other guiding decision-making at the Board of Regents level, there has been a great sense of frustration on the part of many stakeholders, but I think faculty in in particular, because other than the students, our university also is inoperable without its educators, without its faculty. And I think that having this stakeholder representation is really important as a part of the overall functioning of the board.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Any further questions? All right, seeing none, thank you for giving us an introduction to House Bill 9 today. So we will set that bill aside. I will take a brief at ease while we transition to House Bill 31. All right. Will the Education Committee come back to order? We are back on record, and it is 8:31, and we are, well, here we are with HB 31. How about that segue? And Representative Story, improving the Alaska Performance Scholarship. So we will have the bill's first hearing today, and if you want to give us a brief introduction to that, Representative Story, and I believe you do have a couple of invited testifiers as well. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. And whenever you're ready, we will begin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge and Co-Chair Allard and the rest of the committee for hearing this bill today. For the record, I am Representative Andy Story, representing District 3. This bill on the Alaska Performance Scholarship eligibility puts forth changes that were identified in a 10-year program review of the Alaska Performance Scholarship to improve the program, with the goal of increasing student participation to help address Alaska's workforce shortage. Next slide, please. Some background. The Alaska Performance Scholarship, also called APS, was passed in statute in 2010, championed by then-Governor Sean Parnell. The main goals of the APS remain to increase rigor by requiring a challenging course load in high school so students are ready to be successful in their post-secondary training, keep high-achieving students in-state, and help them afford the cost of post-secondary education, and, very importantly, help meet Alaska's workforce needs. To afford the scholarships, at that time, $400 million was placed in the Higher Education Investment Fund. Next slide, please. The concept of the program has been validated. University of Alaska data indicates APS recipients have above average academic outcomes in their classes. They graduate at higher rates than non-APS students, and they're more likely to stay in state long term. The problem, student participation has been significantly declining since 2016, and access is less equitable for students around the state than the program intended. In the most recent year, only 17% of students were eligible for the APS, and of those, only 22% accepted, the lowest in program history of 298 students. This means missed opportunities for Alaskans and the state of Alaska. Alaska is experiencing outmigration and an aging workforce. Here is the graphic that shows 96.9% of working graduates from the University of Alaska are Alaska residents. In 2021, the McKinley Research Group, formerly the McDowell Group, published a report on the APS with recommendations for policy changes to increase the use of APS. The changes proposed in this bill come directly from the recommendations in that report. I'd like to note that we have Rebecca Braun, a consultant from McKinley Research Group who worked on that report, here with us today, and we will hear from her in invited testimony. This bill change requires that students get earlier notifications in their junior year that they qualify for APS. Currently, students are notified at the end of their senior year. Many students are making postgraduate decisions before that. They are putting together their financial packages and comparing it to other options that they have, so it's critical that they know earlier that they qualify, which is why that was one recommendation in the report. Another recommendation is to increase the number of years the scholarships can be used after high school graduation from 6 to 8 years. The report identified what we already know, the majority of Alaska students are what is known as non-traditional students, meaning most are not attending full-time, are working, and have other responsibilities while also taking classes. Another recommendation of the report is to expand the curriculum requirements to allow CTE courses to be included. House Bill 31 adds options for students to apply CTE credits to Alaska Performance Scholarship eligibility. Currently, you can use the APS for post-secondary vocational education, but if you spend time in vocational education classes in high school, they do not count towards eligibility for the APS. In other words, if you spend time in woods, house build, auto mechanics, culinary arts, it's very difficult to qualify for the APS, as those do not count for APS coursework eligibility. As we know, CTE motivates students and helps keep them in high school till graduation. Data from the Department of Education and Early Development shows that over the past 6 years, CTE concentrators had a 19% higher graduation rate than their counterparts. CTE courses must meet rigorous standards also. Alaska's industries need Alaskan workers with certificates and degrees to fill their jobs. In your bill packet, there is a handout of this slide that you might want to pull out for reference as it's easier to read. Wanted to make sure we knew of the current requirements for the program and what would be added if we add CTE classes. So first, and that's an A up there, is the math and science track. So if you are going to qualify for the Alaska Performance Scholarship, you need to follow all the requirements in that track. What this bill proposes is that you can replace one credit of social studies with one credit of CTE. As a reminder, one credit is equivalent to 1 year or two semesters of coursework. Or you could do B, the social studies and language curriculum track for the APS. In adding CTE in this track, you can replace two credits of world language with two credits of CTE, 1 year of which is sequentially more rigorous within a career cluster. Lots of times high school students have career clusters where you are taking House Bill 1, House Bill 2, Computer Aided Drafting 1, Computer Aided Drafting 2, so their courses with sequence and they're called a career cluster. Or the third option that you could take for the APS is the social studies and language track, but you may replace one credit of social studies with one credit of CTE. Again, remembering that is up to 1 year of CTE. Another recommendation from the report and in the bill before you is to increase the award amount. The current award amount is more than a decade old and has not been kept up with the growing cost of education. On average, tuition for Alaska colleges and universities has increased by 44% over the last 12 years, while the support providing to high-achieving students through the APS program has not increased at all. Increasing the amount makes it more affordable and competitive with other offers the student may get. I would like to point out, and you can see on the slide, how the offers would increase the first award level from $4,755 to $7,000. And you can see the other levels there. But I want to point out that these amounts are affordable for Alaska, and within the 7% investment return rate of the Higher Education Investment Fund, as identified in the fiscal note that we received from the Department of Revenue on Saturday. Next slide, please. Another important thing is the changes in this bill would reduce barriers for eligibility. This bill removes testing requirements for the ACT, SAT work keys, as recommended by the report. When the testing requirements was waived during COVID, many more students qualified particularly from rural and underrepresented student groups. This graph in front of you shows a jump of 30% of students eligible. In the 2021 report on page 15, it gives you an exact summary and full data by demographics on this slide. Lack of access to testing, test preparation, and cost is a barrier, especially for remote areas where you must account for transportation and lodging to travel to a certified testing location. In addition, many studies show that GPA is a better indicator of post-secondary success than entrance exam scores, and many higher learning institutions are dropping entrance exam requirements. In conclusion, given our low post-secondary training and education rates and our workforce shortage, the Alaska Performance Scholarship is a powerful but underused tool at Alaska's disposal. Please support these policy changes to help make post-secondary education more affordable, accessible, and revitalize student use. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions. I do have staff here with me today, Miranda Worrell, who can walk us through the bill packet and do a sectional analysis if desired by the chair. And we do have three invited testifiers online.
Thank you, Representative Story. Let's just briefly go through the sectional analysis and then we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruppridge, Co-Chair Allard, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Miranda Worrell, staff to Representative Story. So to go through the sectional analysis as briefly as we can, Section 1 changes Alaska statute, allowing a student to qualify for APS 12 months prior to graduation, rather than 6, from an Alaska State high school. It also amends Alaska statute to incorporate and allow career and technical education coursework in APS eligibility requirements in 3 different pathways. And so these we went over in the slide, but I'll just go through them again. Within the math and science track, a student may replace 1 credit social studies with 1 credit CTE, or a student may replace 2 credits world language with 2 credits CTE, 1 year of which is sequentially more rigorous within a career cluster. Or within the social studies and language track, a student may replace 1 credit social studies with 1 credit CTE. Finally, Section 1 deletes Alaska Statute 14.43.820, subsection A5, to remove the college entrance exam requirement from APS. Section 2 amends Alaska Statute to define a career cluster as a group of jobs and industries that are related to by skills or products, and renumbers the subsection accordingly. Section 3 adds new subsections H and I to Alaska Statute to require earlier notification to students of their progress towards receiving the APS scholarship no later than January 31st, their junior year, and notifying them of an award no later than September 30th in the fall of their senior year. And I'm not sure if this is in the sectional analysis, but it is in the bill changes. It also adds subsections J and K to establish an applicant must be signed up for any remaining course requirements and must have a qualifying GPA. It establishes that the award would be revoked if an applicant fails to complete the requirements, and the GPA upon graduation will be used to conclude the final amount awarded to a student. Finally, Section 4 amends Alaska Statute, and I apologize, it looks like there was a number dropped. That should read Alaska Statute 14.43.825, subsection A. And that is to remove entrance exam requirements and increase the awards amount to the following: $7,000 for level 1, $5,250 for level 2, and $3,500 for level 3. Finally, Section 5 amends Alaska Statute 14.43.825, subsection B, by increasing the number of years a student can use the scholarship after graduating high school from 6 to 8 years.
Thank you. Let's open this up for questions of the bill sponsor. Any questions from the committee? Co-Chair Allen.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Representative Story, for bringing this forward. My first question would be, we had an overbrief with the subcommittee just to give you a little bit of background. Could you tell me on this program how many dollars were left on the table that weren't claimed by students?
Through the chair, one thing with the Higher Education Investment Fund, the student scholarships are paid from the investment earnings each year. So what is really important is the revenues from the fund have been spectacular in the years that the program has been running. And so I believe about $100 million has been spent within the program, and over 11,000 students have benefited. And within the fund, and again, we have to remember that the Higher Education Investment Fund, there was a question on whether it was sweepable or not. And when the $400 million was to be put back in the higher investment education account, some of it, and I do not know the exact numbers, WAMI was taken out, the cost of WAMI, and the cost of doing the program this year. So I believe there's 300 and some million still in the fund. And it's important to keep the fund high and live off the interest earnings, so the program can live on, keep living on and off the interest earnings. I do have Santa Eford in the room who oversees the Alaska Performance Scholarship with the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. If she perhaps could answer that question more thoroughly for you.
May I do a follow-up, please?
Please.
I know the answer. It's $6 million was left on the table last year for our post-secondary education here in the state of Alaska. So don't you, or maybe perhaps you believe that the problem isn't necessarily the lack of funds that have been claimed by the students and the parents, but rather it's the outreach program that hasn't been addressed?
Through the chair, Rep. Allard, thank you for that, and thank you for that information. Most definitely, we have known, and the Commission on Post-Secondary Education is trying to get the word out. Local counselors are trying to get the word out. We definitely want to start in middle school, making families aware of this program. So, yes, we have a lot of work to do, and this report really reflected that need. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Brox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Section 4, we're amending the amounts available for the scholarship. I guess there's two parts to it. At any rate, we're increasing the amounts for the level one at the most, level two, second, and level three the least. And the amounts are based on academic performance in high school. And the net result will be that those that have a lower performing score in high school are probably going to need the most help once they get to college. You're going to have to take pre-college level courses. I forget what they were actually called. But they're least likely to be able to graduate. And that runs into some problems, I guess. Why are we giving more help to those that, if you will, need it less from the perspective of getting through college?
Through the chair, thank you, Rep. Prox, for those questions. The students who are doing the requirements for the APS are very dedicated students. If we run through all the requirements they need to take, these are some of our best students in high school. And so the award amounts are based on their GPA and that they have to take all the credits. It's based on their GPA, and also it's based on currently their testing results. And so it's an encouragement and incentive to do better and to strive to be your best. It doesn't necessarily mean certainly everyone would like to have as much help as college as possible. But the students that come forward to this program are top students. It's shown in the outcomes of the program evaluation that's done every year, that they
are do much better than kids without APS, and they are not having to take remedial classes because they have taken the many years of math. Oftentimes, current students just take 2 years because that's all required statewide to graduate from high school. These students have to take this rigorous course load. And the whole idea behind the program was to encourage students who are high performing to give them help, make it affordable, and keep them in the state of Alaska.
Hello.
Just personal experience remembering from 40-something years ago. The students that specifically were at UAF, those that entered college with a lower GPA were more likely to have to take up below 100 level courses, mm-hmm. and more likely to then drop out. And this doesn't seem to address that problem from the societal value of somebody receiving a university education diploma. I'm wondering if we're spending the money as efficiently as we could.
I thank you for those comments.
Representative McKay.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for your presentation, Representative Story. I'm just a little confused on in the foundation funding formula, step four includes a vocational step up for CTE instruction. So the school districts are already getting money for CTE. So why does a student need a scholarship for something that's already being paid for by the taxpayers? Why do we need a scholarship for something that's already in the formula? I don't quite understand that connection. Plus, it seems like your bill, it may have a lot of merit, but there's a lot of reform in there for one bill, a lot of changes. Thank you.
Through the chair, thank you, Rep. McKay, for those questions. This performance scholarship is for students after they leave high school. And so this is, they're earning it and they're using those CTE classes that the district funds while they're in high school. And so when they go on into their post-secondary, their scholarship could be used. Currently, it's not for any vocational college or vocational university degree that they would want. So the foundation formula is impacting their high school graduation. This is impacting their college work.
Okay, follow up. Do you have a really good example? I sometimes need examples so I can understand. I guess it'd be like if you were an Anchorage high school student and you went to UAA for carpentry or plumbing or something, one of the trades, this scholarship would be for that. The other question, you remember during the last session, I believe the Higher Education Investment Fund was determined non-sweepable by the courts, as I recall. Am I remembering that correctly?
Through the chair, I'll ask the last question first. I'll answer that one first. It was deemed sweepable, and so that is why last session a bill was passed that set up the Higher Education Investment Fund that the legislature made clear that was not sweepable. And so it's not sweepable anymore. It's got its own separate dedicated fund that has been in statute. As far as an example, I'll just use my own local school district. Right now, if I am a person who's taken House Bill 1, House Bill 2, and had some very hands-on experiences, it doesn't count towards this Alaska Performance Scholarship. But say I somehow took extra classes and was able to fit that in and took zero-hour classes and before and qualified, then I would be able to use my scholarship for all of the higher education institutions that we have. in the state of Alaska. And part of the bill packet is a listing of the many institutions we have besides UAA, UAS, UAF. And so I could go to AvTech with my scholarship. I could go to a charter college with my scholarship. I could use all these wonderful institutions that we have. So it opens my options significantly.
Thank you, Representative Story. And then just a reminder for the committee, just to please direct your questions through the chair. Thank you, Representative Story, for doing that correctly. Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Story, thank you for bringing this. And I'm grateful to ACPE for getting the McDowell study in 2021. And everything you have in your bill aligns with their recommendations, including making the numbers more like zero ending numbers, which are easier for families to remember. So you've done a lot of work on this, and I really appreciate that. My question has to do with the $6 million that Alaska students did not collect on the FAFSA for their failure to apply for the FAFSA. We have a lot of work to do in getting kids just to apply for the FAFSA, and that is one of the requirements of this. Can you give more information about why the FAFSA is a requirement? And you know, great credit to the 2011 folks, Governor Parnell and the folks who put this together, because you're basically updating their work. But the FAFSA remains a requirement. Why is that a requirement?
Through the chair, thank you, Rep. Hemshute, for that question. The FAFSA is our free federal aid that all students in the United States are offered based on their financial circumstances. And Alaska, unfortunately, is the state that gets the lowest amount of free federal aid because our high school students are not filling out the FAFSA. I know there's an initiative through the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education to increase that number. And it's so important because if you aren't sure what you have the dollars to go to college and you have to fill out the FAFSA, you will get a letter from the federal government giving you a financial package. And then when you get the performance scholarship, you see, hey, I do have money to go to school. And this is money that is grant money from the federal government that I don't have to pay back. Or there could be a work study option offered with that. So it's just critical that our students know that there are these dollars available to them. And some will change their mind and go on to post-secondary because they realize, because of the FAFSA, that they, hey, I do have money to go to college. We all hear, or you know, our vocational post-secondary institutions.
Follow up?
Through the chair, the FAFSA, when you had the NCSL document, the FAFSA was required for all of those as well, correct? Like, this is a last dollar award.
Thank you, through the chair, for that. Yes, in your packet, we also put together from the National Council of State Legislators, a sampling of what other states' incentive scholarships are for their high school students to get them to stay into state. And when it says it's in the last dollar amount, this scholarship, you would have to take into account your federal dollars and accept that first, and this would come after that. Thank you.
Thank you. I just did have one question. If we increase the dollar amount of the scholarships, would it be your thought that that would reduce the number of scholarships available?
Thank you for that question, Co-Chair Ruffridge. Right now, it would not, because of the low amount of students that we have and because the investment earnings, according to the Department of Revenue, will account for that extra increase, the interest returns at 7%, because that has been the average. And I would like to say that the investment returns, when we have looked at this before, have been in like the high 20s because the stock market was so high for a number of years. Now they are predicting it's going to be around 7%. And maybe down the road, if we get up to what the scholarship intent was, more like, I believe, about 2,000 students they were hoping to take, then that might be an opportunity we have. I wouldn't say it was a problem because it would mean that more students have decided to stay in state and they have, they're good students. They've earned these scholarships that we are giving them. So that would be something on the horizon possibly, but they are predicting that at this point, no, we would not need to. We still would have the money available without having to make an additional appropriation.
Thank you. And thank you for bringing this bill in front of us. Seeing no further questions, we will turn to some invited testimony. Let's start with Rebecca Braun, since she was the consultant from the McKinley Research Group, making sure we don't have any questions or comments on that piece of work. Rebecca, if you wanted to come to the desk here and introduce yourself for the record. And try to keep our testimony brief today, as we do have one more piece of legislation to hear this morning. So thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks. Good morning. Through the chair, for the record, I'm Rebecca Braun with McKinley Research Group, formerly McDowell Group. And I was part of the team that completed the 2021 APS program review that you've heard about. And we also usually do the annual outcomes reports. The most recent was published in January. And I'll talk about that just a little bit. I'll try to be brief. The big picture message I take from our research is that the concept behind the Alaska Performance Scholarship has been validated, but the program's reach has fallen significantly short of expectations. And as a result, the program is just not having the impact that lawmakers intended when they created it in 2010. And those are, generally speaking, keeping high achieving students in state, building a trained, educated workforce. The 2021 report was commissioned by ACPE, which wanted to understand program strengths and weaknesses, especially given declining use of the scholarship. And our research had five components. I'll just mention them briefly so you understand where these recommendations came from. We did a survey of about 3,000 Alaska high school graduates from the classes of 2015 through 2020 who had been eligible for the APS, and about 3,000 from those classes who were not eligible. Those were two different surveys, and we learned a tremendous amount from the responses. We analyzed data from annual APS outcomes reports from the first 10, 11 years of the program, as well as additional demographic data from Department of Labor, for example, to see the longer-term impacts, who was staying in state. And we used data and feedback from school districts statewide, because, of course, school districts do the eligibility determinations. So that enabled us to pinpoint of the three sort of eligibility requirements, how they related to each other. And we interviewed administrators at school districts and at Alaska post-secondary institutions. And finally, we did a literature review on research and trends in standardized testing, particularly the SAT and ACT. And I'll note that wasn't part of our original scope and plan, but because the information from the other four research pieces all really pointed to problems with the testing, we wanted to understand the broader sort of national landscape and what's going on nationally. Together, these pieces did really provide a pretty clear and surprisingly consistent picture of what was going on. And you heard some of that from Representative Story. The most recent APS outcomes report, which was published January 2023 on the high school class of 2022, shows eligibility and use have continued to fall. Only 17% of students were eligible for the APS. That's the lowest rate ever. And we think that a lot of that is because the SAT and ACT tests were reinstated, and many, many institutions have continued not reinstating them, and we think a lot of students just didn't take the tests. So I do want to point out that when students are not eligible because of the test score, but they do meet eligibility standards in their grades and their curriculum, it may not be that they failed the test. That includes all the students who didn't take the tests. And Alaska has a very low rate of taking these tests. Anyway, of the students who were eligible, only 22 accepted the scholarship the fall after graduation, and that came to a total of 293 students, less than 4% of the class of 2022 using it the fall after the graduation. That's the lowest number ever. Just for reference, the number of high school graduates using the scholarship the fall after graduation peaked at about 900 in 2016, and a number, a cohort sort of estimated, I don't know if it was a target, but the number used in fiscal notes for the enabling legislation was 2,300 students per cohort. So that's sort of some bad news. The good news, I'll just go some high level. Surveys and data show a lot of good news. The participants say the scholarship did motivate them in high school. Many participants say the scholarship influenced their decision to stay in state. Participants say it's helping them access the post-secondary training and education they want and reducing their financial stress. And University of Alaska data, and about 96 or 97% of the students go to University of Alaska, that's why I'm mentioning this data, indicates APS recipients have above average academic outcomes. And data from Department of Labor indicates APS recipients are more likely to stay in state long term, or at least for the period we've been able to track. The reports I've mentioned give us a pretty good understanding of the reasons why the program is falling short in terms of eligibility and usage. And there are certainly, there's a role for University of Alaska and there's a role for ACPE, but there are also some important statutory fixes that can help. And that's what I'm here to focus on. And for the most part, our recommendations are in the bill, House Bill 31, before you. I just want to highlight a couple of them. One is the testing requirement. Our recommendation to move the testing requirement. There's strong national evidence that the ACT and the SAT have relatively low value in predicting college success in terms of grades and graduation rates. This is relatively new research, and for example, a major study out of University of Chicago found grades, high school GPA, was 5 times as predictive as the ACT of students' college success. And that sort of jolted, that in a similar study by University of California kind of jolted people, and there's a major trend across the nation in schools going either test optional or variants of that, but generally dropping the test requirement. And Alaska data shows the test is the single biggest barrier to access for all students. And as I noted, this is not just students who don't make the cut score, but because many, many students, especially rural students and students whose parents didn't go to college or students who can't afford it, who work on the weekends, all kinds of reasons, just don't take the test. Back to the APS, I want to point out that removing standardized test requirements would also remove or sort of moot the distinction between the CTE and academic tracks that are currently in the bill. And just to clarify, because I know this is confusing, when students receive the award under the current program, they either get the CTE award, and that is their grades were a certain level, their curriculum met standards, and they took a test called Work Keys and met a certain score. Then they get the CTE award. If their grades met the same standard, their curriculum met the standard, but they took the ACT or SAT and met certain scores, they get what's called sort of the academic award. And they can't change. And one of the things we learned is, and we know, first of all, only about 4% of the students are using the CTE award. And we believe that if we remove the distinction, it simplifies things for everybody. And the world isn't so black and white. And more students might explore CTE, or more students might find their passion shifting and actually be able to pursue what they want without losing their scholarship. Another recommendation we thought was important is to better align award timing with out-of-state awards. So this means using about 3 years, or if really needed 3.5 years, but I believe the bill uses 3 years, which was our recommendation, of grades and curriculum in high school instead of 4. Nationally, schools have really been backing up their dates. I have a daughter who graduated high school in the last few years, and I was really surprised how early the academic the scholarship offers come in. And my daughter's not like national, whatever. She's just a regular kid. Scholarship offers were coming in October, November, December. And the FAFSA, the Federal Financial Aid Application, also backed up its date several years ago. So that whole process has just shifted back. And the summer after graduation, which is when students are now notified, you know, July or August, I think, because it takes time to process all that information from districts, it's just too late if this scholarship really wants to sort of compete with out-of-state options in terms of keeping kids in state. And I would just say we also recommend that if curriculum requirements are tweaked, and there certainly may be some benefit to that, especially to simplifying things, just working with school districts to try to figure out the best way to balance rigor with fairness and access, which I think is everybody's goal here. And finally, we did recommend considering increasing award levels, which have eroded pretty significantly due to inflation and weakened the scholarship's value and particularly its competitiveness. We noticed a trend in the students we surveyed where the more recent it was, the more likely they were to say, those who did not use the scholarship but were eligible, that it was because they got a better financial offer elsewhere, meaning outside the state. To conclude, our research indicates the program has real potential to increase Alaska's low rates of post-secondary training and education to help address our workforce shortage and potentially to slow out migration. But its reach is currently too limited to really achieve these objectives. And from a policy standpoint, this limited impact translates to missed opportunity for Alaska students and for Alaska. Thanks for your time. It's kind of high level. I'd be happy to try to answer your questions, and I know your time's limited, so if people want to follow up with me about some of our studies or data, that's fine too.
Well, thank you so much for that information. Co-Chair Allard, you had a question.
I do. Thank you, and through the chair, thank you for being here. I appreciate all your information. I'm still circling back to my concern is that there is not a lot of we're asking for more dollars for the scholarship, but yet we're not giving to the parents and giving information to the students. So here we are with $6 million left on the table asking for additional funds that we're not going to be able to have the students access. How are you going to solve the problem of parents being notified, students being notified in order to get those funds?
Co-Chair Allard, thanks for the question. That's outside my scope of expertise. That's probably a good question for ACPE. I will say that if you look at sort of the survey results, especially about why students who qualified aren't using it, I think that can be a helpful guide. And there certainly are, I think that making the scholarship come out earlier, the notification, is really going to be helpful in making it useful. I see districts working to let parents know. It's hard. I think it's a challenge. I mean, I'm a parent and I miss like half the stuff that comes from schools, and it's not all their fault. Some of it's my fault, or, you know, I didn't read that email. It's a struggle. I think that all ideas, you know, maybe there's a role for lawmakers too. Hey, everybody, there's this scholarship that's being underused that can really help your family.
Can I do a follow-up, please?
Follow-up, yes.
Thank you. And through the chair, so you were hired to do research in regards to this, but in your survey, you didn't look at finding out why parents and students weren't accessing these funds, scholarships?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Allard, I'm not sure I understand the question.
So when you did it, through the chair, when you were doing the research in order to find out what were some of the reasons these scholarships weren't being accessed, the low retrieval rate of them, it didn't occur to ask the question of why parents and students didn't have the information?
Oh, I see. Thank you. Co-Chair Allard, we did ask that, actually. I would say at this point, it was a few years ago, so I'm not remembering the exact verbiage of our questions, but there were a few data inputs, if you will, and there were the surveys, which were big. And I can go back and I can follow up with you on those surveys. There's a lot of detail. They were big surveys, and we did also get open-ended responses. And school districts, there was a major study of school districts that reached out to all districts, and they gave input. And insight, since they're sort of closer to the source, about where the disconnect is.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative McKay.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I think at least we should ask for a copy of your report. I think we should get that so we can have a closer look. And then I guess maybe this question is more for Rep Story, but how much is in the Higher Education Investment Fund right now? And it looks like the fiscal note is $11,750,000 for FY24 and then going on out in the out years. And so are we asking to put almost $12 million in the Higher Education Investment Fund on top of what's already there? I guess I'm trying to understand the financing here a little bit more. And, you know, we're being asked to fund a lot of programs this year. And, you know, approximately 40%, maybe half of our budget's coming from the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve, as I like to remind people every year. So we're already way outrunning our private sector income to pay for state government. So we need to look at all these dollars very carefully. Thank you.
And before you answer that, Representative McKay, the report from the McDowell or McKinley group was emailed to the committee. Yes, you should have that. Continue, sorry, to the answer to the other question.
Thank you, through the chair, Rep. McKay. Yes, if you will look at that fiscal note of the $11,750,000, that is within the earnings of the Higher Education Investment Fund, and there's a zero change in revenue note right below that. So that money reoccurs from the interest earnings of that total amount, and I will have to get back to you on what is currently in the Higher Education Investment Fund. But the interest that is generated pays for the scholarship each year.
Okay, thank you. So follow up through the chair. So the $11,750 on the fiscal note is just interest from the Higher Education Investment Fund. It's not new money from the general fund.
Thank you very much, Rep. McKay. And if you'll see, it's included in the governor's request, and the fund source is from the Higher Education Investment Fund. So thank you for clarifying that.
Thank you, Representative Story. Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, kind of going back to this section four that I was concerned about. I guess I got to set it up. Again, going back decades, a number of the career and technical education courses were provided through the high schools and not available through the university system in Fairbanks. And did you do any research into using just grade point averages for several different purposes? That too is a little inaccurate because it's somewhat of a matter of aptitude. Personally, when I was in high school, I tried for academic courses, took more rigorous academic courses, and frankly got a lower GPA because of that. Could have taken easier ones and aced them. And then found out that I really had an aptitude more for technical, and I should have focused more on the career in technical. That's where I got the job. Did you do any research into my thought is that we should be focusing more on putting the resources that are going to university level career in technical should be devoted more towards the high school level than the university level. We'd get a better return on investment as the legislature. Did you devote any thought or do any research into that?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, thanks for the question. The short answer is no. That was outside our scope. I certainly have some thoughts about it, and I think there are a few things. One is about the value of career and technical education in high school, and I definitely would support you on that. And I also think that's an important piece of this policy so that students can qualify, or that for students who maybe don't excel and get excited about academics, do excel and get excited about something and stay. So I don't know if that answers your question. I will, one more point that I think you're saying is maybe some of these kids aren't getting the scholarship and aren't therefore able to pursue post-secondary CTE training because of their grades. Mm-hmm. And I think I can speak to that a little bit. There are three tiers in this program, and the lowest tier provides less money, but it's more broadly accessible. It has a lower GPA requirement. And I'm just sort of thinking, so for students who don't have great grades, they may still be able to get that. And usually CTE programs, well, I may be speaking out of turn, they might be a less expensive proposition. And so hopefully that would still help them, especially with the increase in the amounts that are in this bill. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Follow up? Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Braun, for your time and attention to that. Seeing no other questions for you, we will turn to Jennifer Nags, school counselor from Thunder Mountain High School, who has joined us in the room today. Okay. And just keep in mind our time. I plan on this bill being set aside by 9:30 so we can go to House Bill 65. So we have just a few minutes.
Thank you very much. I'm Jennifer Nags, school counselor at Junior Douglas High School, Uda-Akhle, not Thunder Mountain. However, I know a lot of stuff. I've been around a little bit. I would like to say thank everybody. The Alaska Performance Scholarship has made a difference. If you don't know that it does, it does. I want the committee to know that. Less quantitative, more qualitative on my part for you guys is that if we go through piece by piece with the parts that have adjusted or are being proposed to be adjusted, the first one I'm going to say is taking out the testing requirements. When you think of the junior school district, we are in a unique situation where our district, when the state stopped paying for those tests, felt the value in having us still offer them. The district pays for that in a way that most school districts can't, so that students can take that one time during the school day, which increases eligibility opportunities. With students even here in Southeast and Huna, we're seeing that my other school counselor used to work there, so she has connection, trying to get students over from a village to take a Saturday test is difficult. We know planes don't always fly. We know money isn't always there. We know opportunities don't always exist, and that doesn't mean those students haven't taken a rigorous course load. That also happens in Bush. I was on the ACT state committee for a while, and we talked a lot about how do we get the access to those remote communities, remote communities. So I do believe it will increase opportunity, not just for that, but for students who really work hard. Representative Prax, I believe it was you, said CTE makes a difference, right? Kids who work very diligently, and maybe English isn't their first language, or maybe they are first generation. Testing is a certain skill that is different than academics. When you go to college, most things nowadays are project-based. Schools down south aren't requiring those tests. So I've got a student right now, a young lady who's a senior, who literally, when we sat down to do her senior meeting to talk about what her post-secondary plans were, I said, why didn't you, have you applied to one of the Alaska schools or an Alaska program? She said, no. I was like, why not? You were eligible for the APS otherwise. And she said, well, down south I can get more money and not have to take the test. So why would I stay in Alaska? I think that would open up the opportunity. I'm keeping an eye on that time for you. So the next piece for me is the CTE inclusion and keeping the rigor. CTE, career technical education, is really where I'd say the rubber meets the road. It's where your learning in math, science, et cetera, comes together in a real world practical way. I have a young man who graduated last year and he was eligible for APS and used it to go to Avtech. He is, he's a great welder. He's an amazing welder. He's so excited about it. He's everything. He's Alaska native. He's everything you want to have a kid stay in Alaska to be part of our workforce and to be highly educated with that. However, none of his welding classes, his house build classes, the classes that really make the difference for him, counted for his APS. He's lucky that he has a family that understands opportunities, and he has a school counselor, me, who really pushed it. And he had a drive that most kids don't have. But it would have made his life a lot easier. He wouldn't have had to take a zero-hour class when he took his house bill to be able to be eligible. When we're looking at the money, I've got kids right now who are like, the EPS doesn't help me. It's not enough money. I can get more money going to a school with WUI than I can staying here. That same young man who did metals here had offers from places down south to do welding programs down south that gave him more money. He was lucky to get a couple other scholarships to stay here, and the APS made the difference for him. Oh, what else is the change, though? CTE, testing, amounts, and extra opportunities. I don't think you lose rigor. I really don't. When you add CTE and everything else in, your math still stays in place. Three, it's algebra one or above. You're still using letter grades. GPA is a much better predictor of success at the post-secondary world. And then if you can keep kids in Alaska for their post-secondary, everything from certificate programs to degrees, they're more likely to stay here and not leave. And we need a workforce. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions from the committee? All right. Seeing none, thank you for your boots-on-the-ground approach. Appreciate that very much. Representative Story.
Yes, we have one more boots-on-the-ground testifier, Trish Thug, who's online from the MATSU CTE program coordinator.
Yes, thank you. We have online Patricia Zug, from program coordinator with the MATSU Borough School District. Thank you for joining us. You do have 3 minutes.
Oh, mercy. Okay. Co-Chair Allard, Co-Chair Ruffridge, committee members, I am Trish Thug, MATSU Borough School District Career and Tech Ed Program Administrator. I come to you today, I want to fully disclose, I also am a member of the Alaska Workforce Investment Board, and I'm also a commissioner on the Alaska Commission for Post-Secondary Education. So I come to you with great passion. I've had the privilege of serving in career and technical education and workforce development in the state of Alaska for 30 years now. So I'm going to talk really fast because I was through the 5 minutes. But I'm very passionate about this. I think I will also be able to answer. I wrote down all the questions that have come before in previous presenters. Because Rep. Story's bill asked for CTE to be a more utilized piece of the APS eligibility, I want to assure you of its current status, which is delivered with rigor and relevance. The stigma of what you and I likely experienced in high school, which was called vocational ed, told the story of going down that hall in high school where the kids go that are not going to college, where you might do a little exploration of careers. CTE has an intentional name change, largely to break that stigma. It's required now to be delivered in a framework that has 12 evidence-based elements of high-quality CTE. So, example, you know, we have 8 pathways, 32 programs of study, over 200 CTE courses that are stacked in increasing rigor for our students to become what's called a CTE concentrator. We have 28 CT classes aligned to college credit. We have academic credit awarded in our CT classes, evidenced by standards in those academic areas. We have a litany of industry-recognized credentials that our students can attain, and our instructors are anywhere from RN, certified welding inspectors, certified flight instructors, engineers, biochemists. I have a litany here, but I'm trying to be brief. But we're building an RV-12 airplane. We graduate board-certified CNAs. We have private pilots, students sending off to lucrative welding careers. And, you know, to Representative McCabe, I believe, question about, I'm sorry, I'm trying to add, about whether we cap in high school and don't they get these. Yeah, they have these CT experiences, but we know across our state, not all districts enjoy the privilege of that deep of a CT program. So it's vital that these students be able to continue on their path of learning in CTE. So 2/3 of CTE concentrators go on to, it's actually up to 2/3 to 75% go on to some type of post-secondary education experience, whether it's trade schools, apprenticeships, military, but even so, associates, baccalaureates. We have students that are CTE programs that are medical doctors now because they experienced CNA in high school, and wrote to us to testify that that made a very big difference in their trajectory. So it does change the trajectory for their GPA, for their motivation. CTE is not vocational ed. CTE has rigor and it has relevance, and the relevance is what's making a difference in today's education environment. So without taking up too much more time in the testimony to give that clarity to CTE's effectiveness, I think that I would encourage you to really be data-driven, and I think that is the exact reason that I'm here to support Representative Story's bill of modernizing the APS. The current mold many times results in guidance of high school students away from CTE concentration in an effort to simply have them qualify for the APS. And so to that end, I'm not sure today's mold is what we really need for financial aid for further education and training in 2023 in Alaska. Example I'll use is with the current eligibility-fueled guidance. I'll tell you about a class that is happening right now at West High. We're about to deploy in the MATSU and other practitioners and districts across the state. It's called Geometry and Construction and Anton Algebra. It suffice to say, although these classes are indisputably successful in gaining geometry and algebra success and engagement, many times over and above the wall-to-wall geometry classes, and participating in them might not fit the current APS eligibility mold. The APS inception goal of attracting Alaska's brightest and best to attend post-secondary certainly should be foundational. At our current juncture with the exponentially large workforce gap, we should modernize the APS to provide scholarships that have the goal of retaining all young Alaskan students, not just the brightest and best. We're at a confluence where we need all of our young students to stay in Alaska. The out-migration, the workforce gap, all of these really present to us that they should be pretty informative in having us do a paradigm shift. That paradigm shift includes reforming the APS. Again, going really quickly, I have a few more points to make. Modernizing APS is also going to acknowledge that we are moving away from traditional ways of attaining post-secondary education. That's been forever changed, particularly post-COVID. We have non-traditional training centers where students should be able to use their APS. We have university partner programs, doctoral-level programs here in Alaska to provide us with pharmacists, to provide us with medical doctors, many times because they're partner programs and that the technicality and the language of those partnerships does not allow our Alaska students, who are our brightest and best, staying in Alaska to provide those services for you and I, they cannot use their UPS, or their, I'm sorry, their UPS, they cannot use their APS scholarship because they have a technicality in the partnership that they are, in fact, in Alaska 100% doing that education. That calls for a modernization and a rethinking of how we distribute. So I will close by saying, again, in the confluence right now with our workforce crisis, our out-migration and the rapidly decreasing and underutilization of UPS should prove it's imperative that we embrace and deploy some paradigm shifts. And so I ask that you be data-driven and responsive, support Representative Story's House Bill 31 to modernize it. I really believe that it's time to the eligibility and usage of this is made more robust, attractive, and effective in training and educating all Alaskans to stay in Alaska. So this time, I will conclude. I'll thank the committee, both co-chairs, for this opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to entertain questions.
All right. Thank you for that testimony. And if that was written down, and I apologize, you had to hurry, if you could please send that to the committee, I think we would be able to read through that and respond if we had further questions, because we do need to set aside House Bill 31 at this time, and I'm going to take a brief at ease while we transition to House Bill 65. Brief at ease. We will come back to order in this room. Sorry, that got a lot of people like to talk in here. We should have a party later, maybe. We're back on record at 9:35. AM, and we have in front of us House Bill 65. The sponsor is Representative Dan Ortiz, and we are ready for your presentation when you are.
Good morning, Chair Ruffridge and Chair Allard. For the record, my name is Dan Ortiz, and I represent Southern Southeast Alaska District 1, which goes from Wrangell down to Hyder, Alaska, and includes Ketchikan and Metlakatla, Saxman, and Whale Pass and Cochran Cove.
And I'm staff to Representative Ortiz. My name is Caroline Hamp.
Again, members of the committee, Chairs Ruffridge and Allard, I thank you very, very much for the opportunity to bring before you House Bill 65 today. House Bill 65 will increase the base student allocation by $1,250 per eligible student for a total BSA per student of $7,210. As you can see with the recently released fiscal note, the total cost of the increased proposal is $321.5 million. I'm honored to be the sponsor of the bill and to look forward to the important conversation this body needs to have about education funding. Since 2012, co-chairs, inflation has increased by at least 24%, while the BSA has only increased 4.2%. So although we have flat-funded education in recent years, because of inflation, spending power for education funding has actually decreased by almost 20%. This bill tries to bridge the gap by increasing the BSA by about 20%. We have all felt the effects of inflation, especially recently, whether it's while we try to heat our homes or buy a carton of eggs. Those inflationary pressures, Mr. Chair, have also impacted our school districts across the state in a significant way. We have, for example, in the Lower Kuskokwim School District, they have seen a 46% increase in fuel costs alone. In the Juneau School District, they have seen a 155% increase since 2017 in property, liability, auto, and cyber insurance. In the Annette Island School District, which is in my district, electricity costs have gone up by 26%. In the Lower Yukon School District, they've had to supplement their food costs by $1 million per year. Some of these costs, members of the committee, like freight, shipping, are unique to Alaska. Taking into consideration Alaska's specific cost of living, Alaska spends less per pupil in public education than the national average. This particular slide before you shows that, yes, Alaska ranks 6th in the national per pupil K-12 funding in raw dollars. However, in a study conducted by ICER, they found that when 2019 education spending in Alaska was adjusted for the cost of living, Alaska was underfunding education in comparison to the national average. As a result, school districts are having to make difficult decisions to balance their budget. Every district is cutting teachers and increasing classroom sizes. Counselors, librarians, custodians, and other support staff are also potentially on the chopping block. For some specific examples, the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District has considered or decided to close and restructure multiple schools, increase class sizes, and eliminate over 130 positions, including teachers, counselors, classroom aides, and other support staff. In the Kenai Borough Peninsula School District, if there is no increase to the BSA, they would have to eliminate 33 to 49 full-time certified teachers, which would raise the student teacher classroom ratio by plus 5. In the Annette Island School District, they're looking at a 12% decrease in staffing to address the $1.2 million shortfall in this upcoming year. And in the Anchorage School District, they are increasing their pupil teacher ratio in the K-12 system by plus 1 and eliminating 62 full-time teaching positions to save $7.3 million. Fine arts programs, language classes, and even AP classes are at risk if we don't do something about the BSA. After school and extracurricular activities are being cut, and we have heard anecdotally from students that losing the programs they care about, these kinds of programs they care about, greatly, decrease their motivation to stay engaged in school. If we continue to fund education at the current BSA levels, schools will have huge budgetary shortfalls. Anchorage projected that their estimated budget shortfall in FY24 of $68 million and a steadily increasing shortfall of up to $125 million by FY27. In the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District, they're looking at anywhere between a $4.4 to $6.5 million shortfall in the upcoming year if there's no increase to the BSA. This next slide, slide 3, shows some interesting information. Despite the decrease in services, school districts are still prioritizing funding for instruction. Instructional costs make up 70% of education funding expenditures, while administrative costs make up on average about 14% of the total expenditures. School board members, administrators, teachers, and parents and students have testified, whether in previous legislatures or as recently as 2 weeks ago in the other body, for an increase in education spending. And I might note that a large crowd that's behind me today are here in support, I suspect, in support of an increase in funding for the BSA. We are starting to collect testimony for this particular bill, and it's already common to hear from districts that they support the concept of this bill. For example, the Kenai Borough Peninsula School District, along with many other schools, in their legislative priorities for this year, has asked for, quote, an adjustment to the BSA and to develop mechanisms to compensate for inflation. Members of this committee, passing this bill and increasing the BSA will be a significant investment in Alaska's K-12 public education system that will allow school districts to recruit and retain good teachers, reduce class sizes, and give Alaska children the education and tools they need and deserve. Thank you all for thinking critically about our education system, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have or engage in this discussion about this particular bill.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz. Looks like we have a question from Representative Brooks.
Mr. Chairman, do we have invited testimony, or are we?
We do. We have, I believe, one Representative Ortiz, Mr. Garrison, the Executive Director of Association of Alaska School Boards.
I think it would be worthwhile to hear the invited testimony first and then start questions.
And thus we shall do. All right. We will hear. Thank you for that brief presentation. We will have the Executive Director for the Association of Alaska School Boards with invited testimony, Lon Garrison, come to the table and introduce yourself for the record, please. And we are happy to hear from you today.
Good morning. Pardon me. Good morning, Chair Ruffridge, Co-Chair Allard. It's good to be here this morning. I look forward to speaking to you on House Bill 65. My name is Lon Garrison. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. We're a nonprofit organization serving 52 of Alaska's 54 school districts. ASB strongly supports House Bill 65, which would increase the base student allocation by $1,250 starting with the FY24 budget. ASB's Board of Directors has adopted three legislative priorities for the year. They are sufficient, sustainable, and predictable education funding, retention and recruitment of teachers, administrators, and staff, and student wellness and safety. ASB has several resolutions adopted by the association membership supporting each of these priorities, and a document that aligns those resolutions to each of those priorities, and a second document with the complete verbiage of each resolution is appended to the written testimony. My testimony today will focus primarily on the issue of sufficient education funding, which is a critical factor affecting, most importantly, student outcomes, and then the retention and recruitment of staff and the safety and wellness of our students. The state of Alaska has always statutorily filled its responsibility to Article 7, Section 1, of Alaska's Constitution, requiring the funding of a system of public education. However, for over a decade, it has not sufficiently invested the resources necessary to ensure every student receives an excellent education every day. As a result of the inability of the base student allocation to keep pace with inflation, class sizes have increased for many schools. Programs such as world language, art, music, career, and technical education courses, and sometimes even advanced placement courses, have been eliminated. Budgets for school support of personnel, school personnel, and maintenance staff have been reduced, along with many of the needed supplies and materials required to keep schools operating safely and effectively. Many teachers often dip into their own pocketbooks to make sure their classes have the materials they need to engage students actively in learning. I recently performed an analysis looking at the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics measurements for inflation, looking at inflation versus the BSA. Much of that data has already been presented to you, so in the interest of time, I don't see a need to reiterate that information. So if you'd like, that is included in my written testimony. So in November, the ASB Delegate Assembly unanimously approved a resolution Resolution 2.2, urging early, adequate, equitable, and predictable funding of education by specifying an increase in the BSA. An increase of $860 was put forward at the time by the Anchorage School Board as a result of the district's analysis early last fall of the difference between the BSA, the current BSA, and estimated inflation-adjusted value. As I have explained, this early estimate of at least $860 didn't meet the mark. House Bill 65's proposal, $1,250 BSA increase, provides the greatest chance to even the score with inflation, and it does the right thing for our students. So what does this really mean for school boards, which by statute are required to establish, approve, and implement balanced budgets each year? It's meant having to make the hard decisions that reduce staffing, eliminate programs, curtail extracurricular activities, and diminish many of the supports that affect the conditions for learning for each student. Locally elected school boards have been delegated the authority to implement a system of public education required by the Constitution, Alaska Constitution. School board members are tasked with their governing their districts, and allocating funds to execute an educational plan for all public students. It's a highly complex task. In Alaska, school boards have no taxing authority. They therefore must solely rely upon the revenue of the state, the federal government, and in organized areas, at least a minimal local contribution to the education fund. Each year, school board members and education activists appeal for education funding to provide that excellent education for every student every day. A myriad of operational costs, including utilities, supplies, transportation, fuel, maintenance, and freight for operating in the school system have all increased dramatically, as Representative Ortiz displayed. These operational costs have increased the resources to employ staff needed to run the schools and deliver that education support have been reduced. Over the past year, I've heard from school board members and superintendents across the state about the tremendous strain their budgets face. Of particular note are the incredibly inflated fuel costs, which Representative Ortiz just demonstrated as well. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration report of March 2022, the summer heating fuel costs for unsubsidized rural communities was at least 26% higher than it was in the winter of 2021. Heating fuel prices were reported in many locations well over $7 per gallon, and that's even low if you look at the statistics for today. This means the cost of heating school buildings and transporting goods or staff for students significantly impacts the amount of funding available to hire and retain teachers and other support personnel. For example, during discussions last spring, one superintendent of a remote district noted that generally for every $100 in materials that they purchased, they must allocate nearly $200 to get it to their location. The highly uncertain nature of the annual legislative appropriation for education funding as part of the state's general fund budget and the potential executive vetoes continually creates uncertainty that makes it difficult to sustain a maintenance of effort in an effective and efficient manner. Time and again, school boards and superintendents must make hard choices that may result in the reduction of staff or elimination of programs, which often negatively impacts student achievement. Support for House Bill 65, increasing base student allocation, is imperative and meets the request of ASB's Resolution 2.2 of not less than $860 increase to the BSA. Locally elected school boards have been delegated the authority to implement that system of public education on behalf of the state of Alaska. And in order to do that, they rely upon state, local, and federal governments for revenue. School boards implement the local control model that has served Alaska well, but they depend upon your support. I want to thank the committee's support for potentially increasing the BSA as a foundational piece of Alaska's public school system and Alaska's future through the education of its young people. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Garrison. And if you wouldn't mind sending in that written testimony as well. Okay, excellent. And Representative Prox, did you continue to have a question?
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. Through the chair, you mentioned Alaska's Constitution establishes a requirement to fund education. I believe the word is establish a system of education. I don't recall that funding necessarily was in the Constitution. I haven't read that for a couple of years now. Do you recall whether is it funding or establish a system in the Constitution?
I believe the word is establish a system of public education.
Right. And I think that's important because there's been a lot of changes in the way everything works since the Constitution was established and how it was implemented. Follow up. Are you familiar with Kodak, Apple, IBM, and Microsoft?
Yes, through the chair.
And the reason I ask that is Kodak, as my understanding, developed the graphic user interface system, didn't develop it because they were in the camera business and relying on film. Apple Corporation bought the rights to that, and boom, we had Macintosh computers. IBM thought the money was all on mainframe computers. They kept investing in that. Microsoft stole the market with personal computers. And then Apple insisted on keeping their own source. Microsoft let everybody else develop software. And the change in market share, and I think the same thing is going on in the education system. And my question is, does it make sense to just keep throwing money at a system, or now a funding system, that was last changed, I think, was it 2006? Can't remember, the base student allocation system. Do we have a fundamentally flawed method of funding the state education system that doesn't allow for changing markets?
Through the chair, I would say no, we don't. I would say that through the system of local control and the support of the Department of Education and others, we have the ability to create innovation. School districts are being innovative all the time. We're inclusive of other programs such as public charter schools to allow students across the state to become involved in an educational program and an educational model that may best fit their needs. So I think Alaska's public education system is evolving, mm-hmm. And has the opportunity to continue to evolve. I don't think that it should be static. And the idea, that phrase, one size fits all, doesn't work in Alaska, and we know that. I think many of you come from, you know, various different places across the state. And it's easy to demonstrate that, you know, in one place, one model may work well. In another place, different situations arise where students need different types of support and instructional programming. So I would say that, no, I don't think it's the problem of the funding. I think the challenge is to make sure that we're using the funding effectively and that we're meeting the needs of every student across the state and trying to provide that in the best form that we can. And today, frankly, that's a very challenging issue when we have so many other pressures that are affecting our communities, our families, and our students. It's a big lift for public education, and public education has to be responsive to all students. I appreciate the sentiment, and I think it's always good to have the question about, is this the right thing to do? Are we doing it the right way? And I think we always ought to be asking those questions, so I appreciate that question.
Specifically, are you familiar with the situation in the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District where over the years other school districts have, well, Galena, as a case in point, faced a huge impact and they decided to come up with a completely different service delivery model, and now they and other correspondence programs have taken a significant share away from the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District because the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District kind of insisted on the brick and mortar school model. Are you familiar with that at all, or has the board looked at the changing where parents are making the decision to just move away to something else?
Through the chair, I am familiar somewhat with the Fairbanks model and experience, and it's not unusual. We've seen that, I think, with other districts as well. The Galena Correspondence Program has been around quite a long time. It's been an incredibly successful program, and during COVID, we saw a lot of students that actually moved to a correspondence model. And for many of those students, it works well. I think for many students and many parents, they found like it wasn't quite what they needed. And many parents feel like, you know, the opportunity to have their student in a school in direct contact with an education professional suits them best. It's one of those things like it just keeps shifting a little bit. And I think for every district, to understand what they need to do to be responsive to their constituents and to their students is a big challenge. And you can't always pivot on a dime right away. It's a big system. I do think that they're taking a very hard look at exactly how that works, and a lot of districts are, in terms of what part of the correspondence model works the best, what other models can they use to reach out to students, like I said, charter schools and et cetera. So,
thank you. Just my concern is that the funding formula does not encourage that. And we need to look at how that is actually working as a concept for funding schools. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Co-Chair Allard.
Thank you, and through the chair. And I have concerns with the formula also, because I'd like to see more dollars stay in the classroom. But in the increase of the BSA, are you aware of the standards with accountability within our school districts? As I'm Anchorage School District, this is a two-parter, I also know that the student enrollment has decreased. So can you answer to where, when the student enrollment has gone down, I think it's 3,000 Anchorage, but just overall statewide, could you tell me where all those funds are going? Because it's not following the child necessarily.
So, as you know, when school districts are funded, there's a count period that happens in October, and then there's an allocation of funds that is based upon that through the foundation formula. And I think you've heard presentations about that. So that count is the number then that is used for that following year to make certain that that is the funding that the school district has available. There certainly is an opportunity for school districts to lose students, even after that count, or to gain students, which would be an increase in cost. So it can go either way. And I think over time, if you look at things, you'll see trends for most districts. I think within the state, we've seen a decline in enrollment, but at times you may see districts where enrollment goes up. So I don't know that you can say, you know, just because the funding formula said this year, well, what happens if we lose 100 students after the count? Where does that money go? You have to plan for the entire system and anticipate what's going to happen in terms of the number of teachers, the materials, the transportation, those pieces. The next year, you may have to make an adjustment and say, okay, this is what we're going to have. And I think that's what, personally, being on a school board and having done that for many years, that's what we always struggled with, is the number that we're going to use or that we're going to budget for going to be the real number, the number that we actually end up with and the number that we experience. So part of it is a timing issue, and that's what makes it very challenging. And I think in terms of the accountability question, it depends on what you're asking in terms of accountability. If you're asking accountability question about where, you know, what is the budget like and how much is actually spent and where does that go? The school board usually reviews the budget on a regular basis, and then those budgets are audited both by the state and then each school district is required to have an audit. So there's a lot of information that can be gained about, okay, did the school district do the right things? Did they follow the procedures and those issues? What I have come to know from my experience on being on the school board before in Sitka was that sometimes what I thought was transparency and accountability was not always the same thing that maybe you as a parent interpreted. And I think sometimes it's a miscommunication or a presentation of that information. When we would provide information about the district as a whole, we didn't always take into account the idea that we might need to provide information to parents for their child's particular school. So sometimes it can be a communication error there.
Mr. Chair, may I? So do a follow-up through the chair. So I don't, I'm on the, because we're lacking time, I don't want a long, elaborate answer. I think they're very concise questions that I'm asking. The bottom line is I don't see the accountability. We're ranked one of the lowest in the states with education. So I just wanted to know, what are you guys going to, what is the system going to do? Because it's up to the school boards. It's up to each district on how much teachers get paid, not up to me. So I wanted to, one, know it, how much money is going to stay, and you might have to get back to me, yes, how much money is going to stay in the classroom with the teachers and with the students. And with the decrease in students, obviously you've stated the money needs to be able to follow a student, whether that's in school choice or whether it's the child moved and went to a different school district. Because what we're seeing is, based on what you just testified, that the money isn't following the child if the child moves and goes into another school district. So we probably have to look at putting some program in place where if a child moves out of a school district that day, following that student number, gets the funds. So if you can get back to me on just a couple of those, I would appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, absolutely, Chair Allard. And it is after 10 o'clock. I wanted to be clear. Representative McKay, did you have any questions or would go ahead?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we're late. I just wanted to point out for the benefit of everyone that what's being asked for here is a $321.5 million per year increase, which if you divide it by the 1250, you get 257,000 students. And we don't have 257,000 students. We only have about 128,000. So what's being asked for is a base student. We were presented with this graph and this presentation on February 3rd. So I guess we should maybe read that into the record. But what we're being asked to vote on and approve is a base student allocation number that is after all of the adjustments, which some of us, especially me, consider this to be what I would call a black box. There's six increases that you go through to get the final number. So you're not asking for the number over on the left side. You're asking for the adjusted number, which is the $322 million per year. And I think a lot of us feel like there needs to be a lot of examination of these step-ups in this black box that we call the foundation formula. So that's what I wanted to say today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the privilege.
Yep. Thank you, Representative McKay. Representative Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge. And I just wanted to comment that we're always keeping in mind and wanted to point us to the Constitution that was referenced earlier in Article 7, Section 1. The legislature shall be, by general law, establish and maintain the system of public schools open to all children. And so I think that's what we're wrestling with. How do we maintain? We know there's increased costs. We know there's student needs to be met. And so that's what this is all about. But I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Story. Representative Hemshue, no questions. Thank you for your indulgence in going over by a few minutes. Thank you, Mr. Garrison, for your testimony. Hopefully you will return to us at some point in the future. Thank you, Representative Ortiz, for your testimony today. And thank you all who came out in attendance today. And we will set House Bill 65 aside. And if there are no other items of business, I believe Wednesday the committee is taken up with Finance Subcommittee. And then we will return on Friday at 8 a.m. And we will have a presentation on correspondence schools from IDEA and others. So with no other business, we are adjourned at 10:05.